I love you too. My name is Hector Elias, and I'm an alcoholic. And I want to thank you for choosing me over the Cornhuskers. It's just my luck, you know what I mean? Remember when O.J. Simpson was on the freeway driving the white Bronco? I was speaking at a meeting. Nobody was there. It's just my luck, you know what I mean? Oh, God. And we're going to have fun tonight, here tonight, because I believe in laughter. Laughter is the voice of God. We're supposed to be happy, joyous, and free. You know what I mean? We are trudging the road of happy destiny, not the road of disgusting misery. I want to thank Tom for asking me to speak. It's always an honor and privilege to speak at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was thinking how ludicrous this is. This is Middle America, and I come from Middle Argentina. Little did I know, 61 years ago, I was going to be speaking at a meeting in the middle America. It's so incongruous, you know what I mean? This is AA. We're in 140 countries, and it started with two alcoholics talking to each other. Isn't that phenomenal? Anyway, just remember, whatever I said from the podium is just my experience and my opinion. Unfortunately, I happen to be very opinionated. And I may be wrong, but I'm never in doubt. I'm going to tell you my story. I'm going to start at the very beginning. My father is an Arab, my mother is an Italian, and I was born in Argentina. I'm glad you think it's funny. I think I came out Japanese. They were poor, they were illiterate, they were violent, they dressed badly, and they smell even worse. You see, we're poor, poor like in Argentina. Poor in this country is middle class all around the world. You didn't know that. I remember once when I came here, I saw an article about poverty in America. And they had this picture of a black lady in Harlem sitting on a couch watching TV. She's poor. And she has a couch. She's poor and she has a TV set. And the whole article was about how bad the plumbing was. Plumbing! What the hell is plumbing? We don't have no stinking plumbing. We had dirt floors, you know, no gas, no heat, and a smelly outhouse with rock and piss on the floor. I was very ashamed of my house and my parents. You know, they were foreigners. I didn't like that. And my parents were very, very violent. But I didn't know I was an abused child until I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. Here they give you all these problems, you know what I mean? I thought every kid got chained to a sewing machine. My mother used to chain me to a sewing machine, but it was nothing personal, really. She also chained my good sister and the dog, you know, nothing personal. And my father was also very violent. And when they would get angry to fight, my father would pick up a knife or a gun and we'd all run into the street in the middle of the night, half naked. You know, and I didn't mind being chained, you know, you just sit on the floor and pound the tile and daydream about masturbation or something. Well, I didn't have a computer when I was a kid, okay? what she used to do to really frighten me when I was sound asleep and I would do something mischievous, say, I'm not going to try to chase you. You have to come to sleep. So when I was sound asleep at 1 o'clock in the morning, she would uncover me and start beating me up with a shoe or a piece of wood. So for the first 18 years of my life until I left home, I slept totally covered because I never knew what was coming. I didn't like my parents. You know, home was not safe. It was like a minefield. Things were going to explode, and I may be the recipient of that violence. So my first dream as a child was not to be a doctor, a movie star, or president of Argentina. My first dream as a child was to kill my daddy. What are you going to do, Hector, when you grow up? I'm going to kill my daddy. With a dull razor blade. And I'm not telling this, you know, because it has anything to do with my alcoholism. I'm telling you this to tell you how I dealt with it after I got sober. Anyway, when I was 12, I got out of the house because I got into sports and I became an athlete. So I know what these people are doing watching the Cornhuskers. Because when I was a kid, I used to get into fights and I used to lose my voice cheering for my team, the team I played in, you know. And I became an athlete and I got out of the house. I went to the gym, you know, and I went to the gym. And when I was 18, I left my home. And when I was 24, I came to America. Oh, by the way, I came here legally, okay? So don't get any funny ideas. If you don't like my pitch, you cannot call immigration. It's too late now. I've been here 36 years. So, because I knew if I went to another place, you know, nobody will know about my family, my poverty, the filth in my home, and the violence. I had a small problem. I brought Hector with me, you know. And I went to New York, the easiest place, from a hick boy from a little town in Argentina, you know. And I remember I landing in New York, and these tall buildings, I couldn't believe, these mountains of glass and steel that were built by men. And I worked real hard, you know. I always been a worker. I worked real hard, and then I got my little apartment, I got my little things, and I began working in advertising. And it was difficult to communicate at the very beginning because I had studied English. When you come here legally, you have to show that you know English and you have a profession, a certain amount of money, which I had saved. And I couldn't understand anybody because in New York, nobody speaks English. It's Brooklynese, you know. And so I didn't know I had an accent until I went to see this movie with this young lady, and it was a movie with Gina Lollobrigida and Brad Hudson. And all of a sudden, I realized Gina spoke funny. And I said to my date, boy, she has thick accent. And she said, oh, no, it's very charming, just like yours. I have accent? She said, yes. And it's so adorable. I went home the next day and bought a tape recorder. And caca, 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 did I have an accent? I sounded like Frito Bandido. Now I sounded like my parents in Argentina, you know. It was so awful. Now I'm a foreigner. I am just like them. And anyway, I save money, I work hard, and I went to Europe, and I visited 9 countries, and I came back, and I began to accumulate all the things that I had seen in the American magazines. I had the clothes, a nice apartment, the Hanker crystal and little things. I was always into things because I knew if I get all those things, I'm going to be okay. And I was never okay. I was always very isolated. You see, in my home, in the back of the house, because I didn't belong with those people, my mom and dad, I had made with apple boxes and bookshelves. And there I kept all my American magazines, my little things. It was like a little corner. That was my place, and I was always alone. And my apartment in Manhattan became that little place. You know, I was always very isolated. They call loneliness the fear of love. And the book says that most alcoholics, almost all alcoholics, are afflicted by loneliness. And the worst loneliness is the one that when you're surrounded by people, you cannot communicate with any of them, including family. But I didn't know this, you know. And I was very isolated. I don't know what to do. And I asked my boss, Harry Siegel, a nice Jewish man, I said, Hector, you want to socialize? You have to go to a bar. And I said, you'll meet a nice Jewish girl. I said, Harry, I'm Catholic. He says, ah, Hector, circumcision is so easy. 1, 2, 3, you're a Jew. And I went and I stepped into this bar, you know. And I went to this bar and I walked in. It was a crowd of sophisticated men and women talking to each other. I don't see a single Latino in the place. So what is this, a Mormon convention? I don't know. And I noticed that most of the men looked tall, blonde, with crew cuts. And I thought they were a bunch of Mormons. See, because the only Americans I knew back in Argentina, my little town, were the Mormon missionaries. They used to come to our little town to try to change us from unhappy little Catholics to unhappy little Mormons, you know. And they were very nice, you know, and they all dressed the same, dark suits, dark tie, and crew cuts. So the bartender came over and I said, and he said something like, blah, 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 blah. See, English to us sounds like Spanish to you when you don't know the language. But I was prepared. I had rehearsed. I said, whiskey, you know. And she insisted, blah, 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 and I kept saying, whiskey, whiskey. Now in hindsight, he was asking me, what kind of whiskey, on the rocks, with soda, how do you want it? I don't know, I don't understand, I'm new in the country. So I was saying, whiskey, whiskey, he got pissed. He grabbed this stupid bottle with a beacon, little glass, a shot glass, pours the whiskey inside this little glass. I've never seen a shot glass in my entire life before. I've never been to a bar before. So he puts the little glass in front of me, and he walks away. And I looked at this little glass. What does he give me such a little glass? And I looked around, and all the Mormons had tall glasses. Why does he give me such a little glass? Is it because I'm short? Or maybe he's trying to punish me because I'm not a Mormon, you know? I tried to act real macho, so I picked up the glass and I swallowed the whole thing in one gulp. Oh, God, it came out of my ears, my eyes, my nose. It was awful. I almost died. And this Mormon that was standing next to me says, in Spanish, why don't you try Cuba Libre? Ah, Cuba Libre. Easy to pronounce Spanish. Cuba Libre, por favor. Cuba Libre, Cuba Libre. It was rum and coke. Ah, very sweet. Very delicious. I'm addicted to sugar. You know, besides that, I loved it. From then on, I drank everything with Coke. It's Scotch and Coke. Vodka and Coke. And finally graduated to my drink of choice, sangria and Coke. Hey, don't knock it before you try it, okay? Don't give me that. I basically did not like drinking, but I drank a lot. Because when I drank, I was tall. I was sophisticated. I was articulate. I was an asshole. That's what I was. I was a loud asshole. And I got punched a lot and thrown out of places, you know. But I drank. Why did I drink? Why? I tell you why I drank. I never liked anything about myself. Never. Since I was a little child. I remember once I read that Leonardo da Vinci said, and he was a genius, Da Vinci was a genius. He said, the perfectly proportioned man is 7 times the size of his head. So I measure my head. Now, this is extra large, okay? According to that, I am supposed to be 7 feet 2 inches tall. Every time I looked in the mirror, I saw this little midget with his huge head. And in those days, I had an afro. It was even bigger. You see my nose? It looks like a bell pepper, right? Well, I had a nose job. I'm the only person I know who looks the same, before and after. You know, I was trying to change myself because I don't like this. This is not good enough. And I began drinking rapidly. I really began drinking more and more and more and more, you know, and I began drinking by myself in my apartment. I lived in a world of fantasy. You see, I always smiling, and I always shaking your hand, and I always saying yes, yes, but inside I'm dying. And I progress rather rapidly. I'm very addicted to drama, you know what I mean? And I began with my suicide attempts. Within 2 or 3 years, I was really crawling around my apartment asking God to kill me. And I remember when I took the first 40 pills. Don't ask me why I did that. I don't remember. Maybe the door made me say good morning to me. And I'm sensitive. You don't say good morning to me, I'll kill myself. I'll teach you. It's a lesson. You know, and I remember taking the 40 pills, and it was phenomenal. It was like a horizontal line. Very quiet, very peaceful horizontal line coming down. I don't have to be tall. I don't have to be good looking. I don't have to conquer New York. I don't have to speak perfect English. I don't have to do anything. It was very peaceful. Of course it was. I was dying. But the phone rang. I'm in my deathbed, but I'm nosy. I pick up the phone. It was my friend Rudy. And Rudy's wife had attempted the same thing, so he knew. So within 3 minutes, he threatened me, Hector, if you don't call me from the hospital, I call the cops. Click, he hung up. Oh, my God, I want to be dead, but I don't want the cops in my house. How embarrassing. So I floated to Bellevue Hospital, 5 blocks away, and they pumped my stomach, and they forced me to see a shrink. And I began seeing shrinks and shrinks. And they were all good, but as we all know, shrinks can help alcoholics. Because we never tell them the truth. We're pathological liars, you know. They cannot help us. And I began seeing shrinks, and I didn't understand, why am I depressed all the time, you know? And I didn't realize And I said, well, I know what it is. I need to change my profession. Advertising is a cutthroat business, you know what I mean? People are jealous. I have to do something, you know, that's more rewarding, where people love you, they care for you, and they support you. I know what I'm going to do, show business, you know. And but I thought, you know, because I had all the things. I had all the things, but I always felt that garbage. And you told me why I felt that it didn't work. You told me why when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. You said to me, you were looking for a material solution to a spiritual problem. And you told me nothing that I can see with my eyes can fix my insides. Those things are all wonderful. They may give me physical comfort, but not spiritual peace. The book says the main object of this book is to help you find a power greater than yourself that will solve your problem. It's not the right car, the right suit, the right job, or the right house. It's a relationship with a higher power, but I did not know that. And I wanted to accumulate more things. I was to say, I'm going to become an actor. He said, everybody loves me. I'm going to be, my life is going to be perfect, just like Elvis Presley, you know. And I was going to be the greatest actor who ever lived. I was going to do Richard III better than Olivier in London. That's kind of difficult when you can't speak English. And I became an actor. So if I see myself on TV, I'm going to be okay. And I saw myself on TV in a commercial, two commercials, three commercials. Ah, any idiot can do commercial, Hector. You have to do theater. And I always think it when God wants to punish people, you know, he gives them what they pray for. You know, and I got into this play, and this play went to Broadway, you know, which is the ultimate for an actor who wants to do theater. And this play won all the awards on Broadway. And I felt like a piece of garbage. And I had another suicide attempt. And I was more depressed and more isolated. And I really didn't get it. You know, and I kept drinking more and more, you know, and more fights. And I used to get into this fight. I remember once I got into a fight in a restaurant, in a nightclub late. And I said, I'm going to, maybe they punch me out. And they threw me in the street. And I said, I'm going to bring my gun. I'm going to kill all of you. And I go home and get a prop gun that I have from the set. And I said, oh, you son of a bitches, get out. And I'm walking up and down with a phony gun, threatening people. And I didn't think my life was unmanageable when I came to AA, you know. And finally, I had a moment of clarity. I realized what was wrong with me. I really got it. We all have a moment of clarity. I said, my problem is New York. You know, this is a disgusting and unhealthy place, very hostile, very unfriendly. I had to move to a more caring, loving place. So I moved to Hollywood. And, you know, and if you're an isolator like me, you know, you live in New York, you know, at least you go down the elevator or go outside, you know, it's 10,000 people. They are all ready to mug you, but at least they're there, right? You go to L.A., you need a car to get mugged. You know, everything is 3 miles away, so I became more isolated. And I got into this job and that job, and I'm a Latino actor, you know what I mean? I'm always playing bad guy. I'm killing people, molesting women, selling children, you know. I've been handcuffed on TV more times than the Menendez brothers, you know. Always bad guys. And finally I got this part to play a good guy in a movie and a TV movie. It was called Wanted, the Sundance Woman. It was a sequel to the movie Butch Cassidy and Sundance Kid. And I'm going to play a good guy. Finally, I graduated to play a good guy, and I'm so happy. I'm going to play Pancho Villa's right-hand man. And this guy is a good guy, and he's going to save the girl. I'm going to save the girl. So they gave me the part, you know, and then I got home, and I got a telephone call from the casting director. I said, Hector, can you ride a horse? Can I ride a horse? I'm a gaucho from Argentina. I was born on a horse, I told them. I lied. So we got to Phoenix, Arizona, right? And we do all the interiors. Now we're going to do the exteriors. We're going to ride around the jail and save Catherine Ross. So they put me on top of that stupid animal, that horse. And if you ride properly, this is the horse, this is you. Nice. When I did it, it was like this. Oh, the director didn't think it was funny. He had a heart attack. heck do you lie to us? We ask you, this man on the horse, I look at the one unit, why do you do that? And see, they made me practice. They put me on top of that stupid animal for 4 hours to practice. After the 4 hours, I couldn't get off. When I got off, I could not get my legs together. I was walking like this. And my ass was a huge blister. So I couldn't sit. So you know what we do, alcoholics. I got some sangria, some Coca-Cola, went to my hotel, and I got plastered. So the next morning, I come to the set, I had a hangover, and I said to the director, I cannot do this, you know, my ass is a huge blister. And the director said, we don't give a shit, Hector, even if you die, you're going to do it. You lie to us. I have 200 extras now. We cannot stop the take because you cannot do it. So what they did just to make me do the take, they put some wet towels on that thing. What do you call that thing? The saddle, right? Some wet towels on the hotel, and they sat me on top of it. It was so embarrassing. You know what I mean? Here I'm playing heavy-duty macho bandito with the bullets, the mustache, the guns, the hat, and I'm sitting on wet towels. So now they gave me the gun and they said, Hector, we're going to ride around the jail and save the girl, right? And they said, don't cock the gun, Hector. Only cock it after you're galloping and make sure you shoot in the air. See, those blanks are very dangerous. Remember that guy, John Hudson, I think it was, who killed himself with a blank? If I get you this close, I'll blow your eyes out. But I had a hangover, right? So, and the way they did it, the six of us principals were lined up in the horses, and they had those tall guys, the Marlboro guys, the Wranglers, hold the reins of the horse by the rein. When they say action, slap the horses in the ass, and we take off. I'm terrified. I have a hangover. I look behind me. It's like 100 extras, Mexican extras, on horses. If I fall, I'm dead. So I'm going to cock the gun. At least I get one shot out, right? So I cock the gun and I hold it like this and I close my eyes and the horse goes, boom. Oh my God, I shot the Wrangler in the ass. Oh, he didn't think it was funny. So we do the take, right? Now we're going to do a retake. Now the Wrangler's holding the horse like this. Right? I'm an alcoholic, but I'm not stupid. I cock the gun again. But I don't hold like I hold it next to my leg. And the horse goes, boom. Oh my God, I shot my leg. My costume is in flames. I don't give a shit. I want to save the girl. I'm an alcoholic. So we gallop, you know, and these flames that keep growing, right? When we finish the take, my whole costume is in place. So they get some blankets and they put the flames out and they rush me to the hospital and I have a hole like this. And it's funny, when you're drunk, you don't feel nothing. I was just chatting and joking with everybody and had a hole about this big on my calf. I still have it. So they rush me to the hospital, right? And I had to be in the hospital for the full month because it got infected, and I had to have two operations. One to remove the infection, one for a skin graft. While I was in the hospital, my agent didn't send me flowers. And I'm sensitive. You don't send me flowers, I'll teach you a lesson. I'll kill myself. So I asked my friend Irene to bring me the pills, and she brought me the pills, and I took about 40 of them. And that was my last suicide attempt and my best one. I was in coma for 3 days in the intensive care unit. While I was in coma, I had two cardiac arrests. They had to revive me twice. And I was in coma for 3 days. I was dead for 3 days, basically. When I came to, I had about 14, 15 tubes this way, that way, this way, this way, this way. I also developed pneumonia. And my crotch was a huge blister because I kept urinating on myself because I had lost the control of my bowels. So I was dead for 3 days. And when I came to, not only had the tubes, I was strapped to the bed because I kept fighting my delirium, you know. And they thought I was going to die. And I had everything. I had everything. I had the apartment. I had the clothes. I had a beautiful view of Hollywood. I had enough money in the bank to live a whole year without working. I had a brand new Mercedes. I had everything. The only thing I didn't have was Hector. I was just an empty shell with nothing inside. One of you described me once in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, I was a huge ball of fear covered with a little human skin. That was me. I was 42 years old. I was a pathetic little man, the most frightened little man you ever seen in your entire life. I was so afraid, and I was always acting tough. I was so frightened. Anyway, I got out of the hospital, and I went home, and I didn't stop. I continued drinking for like another 8 months, 9 months, and taking some pills. I didn't take pills usually when I wanted to kill myself. Oh, I'm lying. Once I took a pill. This guy in the gym gave me one of those called Black Beauties. And he said to me, Hector, he said, they give you a lot of energy. So I took one of them. I cleaned my apartment 3 times in one day. I made plans for the whole rest of my life. I kept writing, you know what I mean? The only thing is I couldn't close my mouth. It was like this. Never again. Let me have sangria and coke. You know. Anyway, my shrink sent me to Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, Hector, you're an alcoholic. Go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Are you sure, Mike? Yes, I'm sure. And I went to the meeting. It was dark and seedy and very, I said, oh, no, caca, caca, caca. I'm a winner. I don't belong here. I thought he was going to forget, but 2 weeks later he said again, you know, Hector, do you go to Alcoholics Anonymous? I said, no, I didn't. He says, I went to one meeting. It was so awful, dark, seedy. He said, Hector, in those days, 18 years ago, it was 14 candid meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Choose another one. And I went to another one. It was well lit like this, and the people were wonderful. Somebody was playing the piano. I said, wow, this looks like a musical comedy. I think maybe I belong here. And I've been sober 18 and a half years, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best thing that's ever happened to me. I call AA the mafia of love. Newcomers, once you come to a few meetings, you can't get out. We are everywhere. Especially newcomers, when you're coming out of the 7-Eleven at 1 o'clock in the morning with a little brown bag in your hand, you're going to see one of us and going to say, hi, how are you? We haven't seen your meetings. Anyway, newcomers, stay with us, okay? Nobody wants you anyway. This is it. No, really, stay with us and let us love you until you learn how to love yourself. That's what life is all about, is to love and to be loved, you know. And from the very beginning, I got very involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I went to a meeting for every day for the first 2 years. I always had 3 commitments. And I studied the book, I pray and meditated, but for the first year and a half, I didn't get a sponsor. He's going to ask me to do 4th and 5th. And then when he knows the piece of garbage that I am, he's not going to want to sponsor me anymore. So in the first year, I heard somebody saying that if you have a good sex life, you don't need to work the steps. So I followed that technique. I stayed sober, but I was tired all the time. And then I got into food, I went to donuts, Winchell Donuts. I went to Winchell Donuts, the Winchell Donuts Church, I used to call it. I sit at 12 o'clock, because I was not working the steps, I was just going to meetings. Going to meetings is another program, you know. And every night about 11, 12 o'clock, I would go to a Winchell Donuts and eat 6 donuts, 4 chocolate donuts and 2 apple fritters. And then walk across the street and buy some Diet Coke. So, and I gained about 40 pounds. And somebody in my group's sector, we turned our will and our lives over to the care of God, not over to the care of the refrigerator. And Haagen-Dazs is not a good name for a higher power. So I went to the other program, you know, and I found a few things, you know, is that alcohol kills 100,000 people a year, fat kills 300,000. Cigarettes, 450,000. So I had to really work the steps and stop abusing myself with food or anything else or sex. And I did this the 4th and 5th with my sponsor. And to my great astonishment, He still liked me. I said, Ralphie, now that you know all the garbage I've done, do you still love me? He says, Hector, now I love you more. Because now you don't have to pretend to be perfect anymore. In AA, we get here, you know, not to be perfect, to improve. There is no perfection. Desire for perfection is a desire for failure, because there is no 10. Only God is a 10. You know? And I worked the steps, and I kept on doing, you know, my commitments. I still have 3 commitments right now. And but at the very beginning, I had a great deal of difficulty with God. I come from a religious background. I mean, not religious, from a Catholic background. And my God was a punishing God. My God looked like Charlton Heston, and he behaved like Leona Hemsley. You know what I mean? This is not a friendly God. So I had to find a God that really worked for me. And I had to understand what the steps were all about, because I didn't know for the longest time. And I found this definition of God by Joel Goldsmith, and I want to share it with you. But remember, it only applies to me. This definition helped me. He says, regardless of how high my concept of God is, it is wrong. Because it is still a concept. Eventually, I have to lose all concepts and reach the consciousness that God is. And then leave that subject alone, because with the mind, I'm never going to know what God is. And the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 46 is the same thing. Even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend that power which is God. And on page 53 the big book says, God is everything or else he is nothing. God either is or he isn't. What was our choice to be? And that's what I believe that God is. Finite little Hector cannot define the spiritual entity that takes care of 6 billion people at the same time. Theologians and great religious authorities have not been able to do it for 2,000 years. You know, but I know that God is. How do I know that God is? You proof of it. You believe in God. You try to do God's will. Not only stay sober, but you become walking miracles. Remember, all of us, before we came here, we were colossal failures. And look around. This room is full of walking miracles. So God is, and people who believe in God and doing God's will change, transform their lives. Why is it a man wants? I read a book that called The History of God for a female theologian, an English female theologian, and he was talking about God, and she said God is man's most interesting idea. Why is man always long for a relationship with a higher power? And she says, because we want to elevate our lives, to take it to a different plane. You see? All those things that we accumulate are wonderful. They're wonderful. The car, the house, the relationship. But the decorations on the Christmas tree, first we have to have the Christmas tree, and that's me. The other things are just decorations. But I didn't know all this. Where do I find God? The book tells me on page 55, we found the great reality deep down within us. In the last analysis, it is only there that he may be found. It was so with us. You see, I spent a lot of long-distance telephone calls with God because I thought he was floating someplace out there. And you taught me here that God, the kingdom of God, is within. It's inside. And anyway, and for the longest time, I didn't know what the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were for. We all say yes is to achieve sobriety. And yes, the end result of working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous is sobriety. But if you notice, the word sobriety is not mentioned in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. The word recovery is not mentioned in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Not even the name of our disease, alcoholism, is mentioned in 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. But there is one word that's mentioned 9 times in the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Check it out. That word is God. That word is God. For me, the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, just for me, are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. I think in the book says, alcohol is cunning, baffling, and powerful. But there is one, not two, not three. There is one that has all power. Not 75% of the power, 90%. All power. Then they name it. That one is God. May you find him now. and then they list the steps. So for me, the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are spiritual tools to develop a conscious contact with God. Who has to be conscious? I have to be conscious. Not God. God knows where I am all the time. He didn't lose my file. He knows where I am. One of the things that we say in AA is, you know, sobriety is a gift. I don't believe that. And I'm not fighting anybody. I don't believe that. God's grace is a gift. But if you notice, the word gift and the big book about Alcoholics Anonymous is not mentioned. But the word grace is mentioned many times. Because sobriety is a gift, and we are the gifted ones. How about the 90% who doesn't get sober? God doesn't love them? Doesn't give them the gift? That's a punishing God. That's an executioner, not a God. The power of God, or God's grace, is available to everybody. God's grace is like the sun. When it comes out, the sun, it doesn't shine just on the good little people who are sober, the people who go to church or a synagogue. The sun shines on everybody, the child molester, the killers, the rapist. It shines on everybody. But if I get inside my house and I pull down the curtains, God, the sun cannot shine on me. God's grace is available to all of us. The power of God is available to all of us. The power of God is the most important, the greatest, the most powerful thing in the world. It's the same power that gets a little seed into a big tree, that makes the cosmos rotate perfectly, that gets an embryo, makes an embryo into a baby. That power is functioning in me all the time, a full force inside of me. And what are the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous? They are tools to learn how to harness that power so that I have a better life, I achieve peace, and I don't have to act like an idiot and drink. The first step says I have a disease. The second step, I need a solution. The third step says that solution is God. I had to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I didn't know what my will was, and I didn't know my life, and somebody told me. My will is my thoughts. My life is my actions. The sum total of my actions. Somebody said, a man or a woman is not judged by what he does, but by what he wears, how much he makes, or what he drives. A man or a woman is judged by his actions. Your actions speak so loud, I cannot hear what you're saying. So now I'm step three, and how I'm going to turn my will and my life over to the care of God, simply by working the rest of the steps. But the book tells me that I'm blocked from the sunshine of the Spirit. What are these blockages? I didn't know. Are my character defects. I had to get rid of them. So I had to do 4 and 5. I had to list them and then share with my sponsor, with God, and with myself. So I know what's blocking me from God. 4 and 5 is a relationship with myself. Then I have to go home and do 6 and 7. I have to look at this list to see if I forgot something, and then humbly ask God to remove these character defects. And the book says that most of them will be removed, but some of them will have to be content with improvement. That's why Bill Wilson, who wrote the big book in the 12 and 12, designed step number 10 later on. Am I ready to receive God's grace? Well, not really. You see, when I was drinking, I hurt you, and I robbed this, and I insulted this. I had to do 8 and 9. I had to make a list of all the people I have harmed and make amends. 8 and 9 is my relationship with the world. And I had to clean that up. And after I do that, I'm ready to receive God's grace, yes. But Bill Wilson knew we were alcoholics, and we were going to screw up on a daily basis. So he gave us a daily tool, number 10. When we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. And now that I have a relationship with a higher power, how do I improve that? Very simply, by prayer and meditation. What is prayer? You told me prayer is a dialogue with God. And that I have to pray. I have to talk to God. You also told me I can only pray for God's will and the power to carry that out. I cannot pray for anything. Why is that? Because I don't know what's good for me. If I tell God, you know, that I deserve a Cadillac, he may have a Rolls Royce in mind for me. Because, you see, I thought I knew what was good for me. See myself on TV, on Broadway, buying a Mercedes. I got all that garbage, and I ended up dead an intensive care unit. So obviously I don't know what's good for me. But I have to pray. I have to pray. I have to keep this dialogue going with God. I have to pray constantly. It doesn't have to be 4 hours, just maybe 30 seconds, you know. And what do I do after I pray? I shut up. I shut up. And I listen. Prayer is a dialogue with God. Meditation is just listening to the small, still small voice that is inside of me. I didn't know all this. I had to learn. Somebody said the highest form of prayer is silence. Silence is the language of God. I didn't know that. And I pray and meditate almost every day. Sometimes I forget that. I always pray. You know. And what happens after I develop some sort of contact with God and some modicum of spiritual life? There's only one purpose, to help you. That's it. I can have the most wonderful spiritual program, but if I'm not really helping somebody or doing some service, it's worth nothing. The book says, faith without works is dead, and it says it twice. I have to do something to help others, you know. Anyway, I worked the steps, and I had a sponsor, and I kept my commitment. And after 2 or 3 years in the program, I still felt very uncomfortable. Something was wrong, and I didn't know what it was. And I began writing. And then all of a sudden, I realized that I still hated my parents. I really resented them. And the book says that resentment is the number one offender. It kills more alcoholics than anything else. And it doesn't accept parents. They're not exceptions. So you can forgive anybody but not forgive your parents. You can hate your parents. No, 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 no. You know. And somebody told me, you know, that hating your parents is like saying, I'm an apple, but I hate apple trees. If I don't like my source, how am I going to feel good about myself? So I have to do inventory. And somebody else told me that, you know, having a resentment is like drinking poison but expecting the other person to die. It doesn't work. You know, and I really still was very ashamed of my parents and I hated my parents. But I had to make inventory and I found 14 ways that I acted exactly like my father. And I realized also about something else. We have double standards in Alcoholics Anonymous. If a newcomer walks through that door and he says, I just got out of jail, I killed 5 people and I robbed 10 banks, but I want to be sober. Oh, welcome, you're one of us. You want some cookies and coffee? And after the meeting, we'll take you out to dinner. Instant forgiveness. Not with our parents. They had to be perfect. Are we perfect? I don't know about you, but I know about me. When I went to do the 8th and 9th, I didn't want justice. I wanted forgiveness. If I was to get justice for all the garbage I did when I was drinking, you don't want to be standing next to me when I get it. You know? So I made inventory about my parents. And yes, they made some mistakes. So did I. In sobriety. And I want you to forgive me. And you do. And I forgive you for your mistakes. You know, yes, my mother chained me to a sewing machine and she beat me a few times. And that is wrong. I'm not condoning child abuse. That was wrong. But also I had to look at the whole picture. That was 20% of the picture. She got up every day at 5 o'clock in the morning, worked every day until 11 o'clock at night. There's no welfare in Argentina. She had 2 jobs. And I remember when I was a child, we didn't have money for a Christmas tree when I was 5 years old. So she grabbed a broomstick, some wires, some crepe paper, and she made a Christmas tree. 4 branches, 5 branches, 6 branches. She went out with a quarter and bought 4 Christmas balls on a point. But guess what? I have my Christmas tree. And every year got a little bigger. And she always make the ornaments. And when I was 12 years old, she bought me a bicycle. It's almost like buying a car, a kid a car right now. She was working at 2 jobs. She always bought me new books. And at night, because it was very cold and we had no heat, she would heat a brick on the stove, wrap it on an old rag, and heat my bed and put it on my feet so I would be warm. She was doing the best she could with the tools she had. Remember, she was illiterate. Some of us don't get it at home, but at least we went to school and we got some idea of what life was all about. She never went to school. So when I had like 2 or 3 years sobriety, I sent her a ticket. She had never been on the plane. And she got on a plane and she came to Los Angeles to visit me at my apartment. It had a 12-feet tall Christmas tree decorated in her favorite colors, pink and red. And underneath the Christmas tree I had wrapped 33 presents. 33 presents. We overdo things in AA. And I told my mom how much I loved her. And I told her that she was a good mom. And I thanked her for sending me to school, for buying me drawing lessons, for buying me the sneakers and the books, and for all the efforts she made to help me educate myself. And I healed that relationship with my mom. Of course, she would drive me crazy after an hour I stayed with my mom, because she's my mom. But also, she taught me that not that I'm a grown-up, I don't need the approval of my parents anymore. Because if I keep seeking the approval of my parents, I shall remain forever a child. What I need now is a sponsor. You know, somebody said something very funny at a meeting the other day about mothers. You know, they were bitching about mothers, guys. And he said, listen, I've just learned this, the following thing. When you go visit your mother, agree with everything she says, never tell her your plans, and then do whatever you want to do. You know, that's kind of funny. Anyway, my mother came, I brought her back to America for a second trip, and she came with my sister Olga. And I overheard this conversation in the living room. They were talking, and my mother says to my sister Olga, you know what I wish for all the mothers in the world? And my sister Olga says, what? And my mother says, that all the mothers of the world could have a son like my Hector. It doesn't get any better than that. She died 2 years ago. She was 90 years old. And my heart is at peace. That relationship was healed. But I forgot about my father. And I had to wait like another 10 years before I remembered that I really resented my father. Actually, I hated my father. And then all of a sudden, God works in mysterious ways. I get a letter from Syria. He had moved to Syria and remarried, had another family. And he found my address and he sent me a letter. And the letter says, how you doing, son? I just want to get in touch with you. I want to know how you're doing. Oh, by the way, I need some money because I had to pay some taxes. Can you send me so many dollars to pay the taxes? Oh, and one more thing. My family here says, if nobody talks to me from the other side of the ocean, I must have done something wrong. And if I did, I apologize. Did you do something wrong? And I began writing back. And I began listing everything he did wrong. And I am sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and I don't lie. And this is a long list. And then I made a mistake. I asked an old timer what to do. Never do that. And she said, Hector, if your daddy took 10 years to write to you, why did you have to answer right away? And Hector, would you rather be at peace? Or would you rather be right? I'd rather be right. I waited 50 years for this. But I'm a people pleaser, you know, and I called my father and said, I'm going to come to visit you. And 3 months later, I called him on the phone and he sounded senile. And I said, well, I'll be there in 3 months. And I showed up in Damascus Airport to see this giant that used to beat me up. And all of a sudden, I see this little man about this tall, with baggy pants and wispy white hair, running towards me. Oh my God, that's my father? This little man? And he grabs me, and he starts kissing me, and he's sobbing. And I begin to sob with my father in the middle of the Damascus airport with this man I don't know. I don't know my dad. My dad never spoke to me, and the family behind him is crying. They're sobbing, and people watching us are sobbing, you know what I mean? And then he grabs me by the hand like a five-year-old. He takes me to the taxi, and he takes me to the hotel where he's staying. And he told me he couldn't sleep the last three nights because he was so excited I was coming. And my brother-in-law told me that, no, he was not senile when you called from America. He was sobbing so much he couldn't talk on the phone because you had called. So we had to grab the phone away from him. And they finished the conversation. And then he took me to his village. And I learned the story about my father. You know, it's like, I didn't know. I never talked to him. He didn't have a father. His father died when he was 6 months old. His mom was 16 years old. She never went to school. My father never went to school. He grew up in this little village, this very, very poor village. How is this man going to know how to be a loving, caring, nurturing father? He had no idea. This is my father. I want this for a father. I want Nelson Rockefeller for a father. You know what I mean? Money, property, prestige, class, background glass. You know what I mean? No, no, no. Hector, this is your daddy. That he loved me. He really loved me. You know, he made me dress in the three-piece suit in this very poor village. I cannot describe how poor it is. But if you've been to Mexico, that's like Switzerland compared to Syria. You know, his house is the only one with a bathroom. Actually, not a bathroom, a toilet. That's how poor our village was. He made me dress in the three-piece suit. He sits me in the living room in front of a table. He puts steak and makes me eat it, right, in my three-piece suit. And he invites all the villagers from the village to come and look at my friend, my son. That's my Hector from America. And everybody had to shake my hand and come and greet me. Even a blind person without shoes walked in, and they guided his hand to touch my face, that he too may know what Brahim's son looked like. That's how much he loved me. I just did not love him. I just did not love my dad. He followed me around for 8 days like a puppy dog. And I filmed him and I photographed him. And when I left at the Damascus airport, we were both sobbing. Because he was 80-something. I knew I was never going back to Syria, so I was not going to see him again. We were both sobbing and sobbing. And I said, Dad, I love you very, very much. And I'm so proud that you are my dad. And he grabbed my face and kissed me in the mouth and he said, Son, I am 10 times more proud that you are my son. And this trip you made here is the most beautiful gift anybody could have given me in the entire world. No money in the entire world could make me happier. And we hugged and hugged and I left. And when I came back to America, something had changed. Something very subtle. I always looked like a man. I dressed like a man. I accomplished like a man. I sounded like a man. But inside, I always felt like a 12-year-old. Because, you see, being like a man was being like my father. And I hated my father. You know. And now when I think about my dad, I smile. And now I know what a real man is, or a real woman. It's somebody who's at peace with herself or himself. That's the secret, peace, inner peace. We seem to be in a society now that are all crazy. Remember, we used to drive the car, now we drive the car, we talk on the phone, we eat sandwich, and we listen to music. Soon we're going to have a fax machine inside the car. That's what successful life is all about. The spiritual life is totally the opposite. Calm, peaceful, quiet, meditation, prayer. Those things are good, but they're not really... The other day I realized about something, and I have a beautiful home, and I keep redecorating my home. It used to be white, my WASP period, and it was all white, you know what I mean, very all American. Now I'm doing... That's an Italian village, and not an Italian, a villa. And I say, Hector, you keep redecorating your home, but you don't live in your home. You don't live in your living room. You don't live in your bedroom, in the beautiful garden, and the music room. You live in your mind, Hector. This is what you have to redecorate. This is what you have to change. That's what the book says. I think the main problem with the alcoholic centered in his mind rather than his body. This is what has to change. I have to align my thoughts to the thoughts of God so that I will not drink and I will not act like an idiot. But I keep redecorating my house. Stop, Hector. Stop. You see, people talk about relationships, and they're important because we learn through other people. But the most important relationship is with myself. See, how can I get a divorce from Hector? I cannot leave Hector and go to a movie. I'm stuck with Hector. So I have to learn how to live with Hector. You see, the 12 steps are tools not to work on my spouse or my friends, my relationship, whatever. It's to work on Hector. We are not in AA to change the world. We are in AA to learn how to function within the world we have. Anyway, I went to see a movie once called The Elephant Man. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's about this very deformed, ugly person. He's like a monster, and he lives in the streets. And he eats garbage from the garbage cans, and he dresses in rags, and he smells bad. And the kids chase him because he's like this disgusting, and they throw rocks on him, you know, get away, get away. And this doctor and this nurse pick him up and bring him to the hospital to study him. And they treat him with love, and they bathe him, and they put nice fresh clothes on him. And they treat him properly. And lo and behold, the guy is really articulate. He's kind of talented. And he talks rather well. And people come and partake in conversation with him. And you look at him and I say, wow, I'd like to be friends with him. I wouldn't mind having him as a friend. Even the face did not change. But we got to see what he was. We got to see the child of God is inside of him. It's like Dr. Chopra says, you know, we're all God and goddesses, God and goddesses in embryo, ready to flourish, to come out. There's divinity inside of all of us. And when I look at that, I say, wow. That's the story of all of us in Alcoholics Anonymous, just like this guy. We come here, you know, feeling ugly inside and out, so uncomfortable. And the love, the tenderness, the care, the direction, the support that we get in these meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, little by little, the layers built on fear start to come down. Very slowly they come down. And eventually the most beautiful person in the world emerges, ourselves. See, God made no mistakes. We're all children of God. We just have to get in touch with it. That's what the book says. It's a conscious contact with God. I have to be conscious that that power is functioning inside of me. I have to be conscious that I'm an extension of God's love. You know, and that's what the steps are for, to get in touch with that thing that is inside of us. Sometimes when newcomers walk through the door, they think they're going to get something. No, no. We're going to teach them how to use what they already have. God doesn't give anything to anybody, because whatever he has to give, you already got it. It's inside of you. God is not Santa Claus and goes and gives you a Rolls Royce and you a Pinto, you a mansion and you a lousy apartment. God is not Santa Claus. Whatever he has to give, we got it already. It's inside of us. It's a gift of divinity. We just have to learn how to get in touch with it. Anyway, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous to stop drinking. And you beautiful people taught me how to live. Thank you.